As our lives continue to be affected in so many different ways by our current global health crisis, the impact can sometimes be very challenging. This is Lisa Berry, and though our reactions and responses to COVID-19 may be mixed, there are some realities we need to face as we struggle to get through this with the hopes of coming out healthy and perhaps even stronger on the other side. Offering a realistic, science-based perspective on where we are now in dealing with COVID-19, in an article recently published in The New Yorker, we're joined now on 89.1 WEMU by physician, medical historian, and director of the University of Michigan Center for the History of Medicine, Dr. Howard Markell. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
Congratulations on your New Yorker article. What prompted you to write this?
Well, they called me.
That's always good.
It was a phone call I've been waiting for 40 years, so I was at the phone ready to answer when they did.
It's a very realistic look at what's happening right now, and some of my takeaways include you saying the harsh truth about our situation is clear. It isn't over. Tell us more about that.
Yes. Well, I mean, we see mounting cases every day. And sadly, we see mounting deaths every day. We also are experiencing here in the United States more cases of COVID-19 than anywhere in the world by quite a stretch. And so we're clearly not doing what we need to do to contain it. It is clearly spreading. And because it's such a stealthy virus and we don't know who precisely will it attack and sicken? We have a pretty good idea, but we don't know the complete picture. It's making a great many of our loved ones very ill, and some of them die. So it's a very real threat. It's still in our face, and it's not going away because the virus is still circulating quite widely.
So in your article for The New Yorker, you do offer some bottom line advice for businesses, schools, and institutions. Can you share some of that with us?
Well, the reality is that we are not ready for an open society. And you'll notice if you look at the numbers or you look at the epi curves that when the social distancing measures were lifted, I really hate the word lockdown. It's inappropriate, and people who use it have clearly never been in a lockdown. Mm. But when those measures were lifted, the cases rose and continue to rise. So we know that the social distancing measures, which, as I said in the article, are merely an attempt to hide from the virus. They don't cure the virus. They don't make you immune to the virus, and they don't kill it. But we're hiding from it. But as we started going back out, the cases and deaths rose. And they particularly explode in big parties where people are all together, or bars where people are disinhibited from the alcohol they're drinking, or other places where people are not taking very simple precautions like wearing a mask. So in my opinion, in my medical and measured public health opinion, is that we're not ready for business as usual or school as usual. The risks are simply too high. And so I'm an advocate of continuing to flatten the curve and keep it flat until we can actually end this battle with an effective vaccine.
So you go as far to write in this article, though, that restaurants should not have indoor dining. They should keep those closed. And are you saying colleges and schools should not go back to having in-person classes?
Yeah, I believe that. This is my opinion, by the way. I'm an employee of the University of Michigan, but I don't run it, and that's probably a good thing. But I think it's really problematic for young people to be living in dormitories, even though certain steps will be taken. I also worry about 3/4 of the population, student population, that live off campus and are not subject to rules and regulations. And, you know, young people have parties, they interact on many different levels. That's what young people do. And all of those interactions can help spread the virus and can potentially spread the virus to people who are vulnerable to it. So we could see an explosion of cases in college towns like Ypsilanti and Ann Arbor if it's business as usual. So given the remarkable advances we have in long distance learning. I think the better part of valor is to go long distance and to have our students not come back to the college towns where they generally reside this fall.
I know it's only been about 5 months, but I think a lot of people are aching for life to go back to how it was before we started dealing with this pandemic. I don't know where you stand on this as far as academically and as a physician, as a medical historian, but do you have any thoughts about how do we sustain what we need to do to keep the flattening the curve and defeating this virus?
Well, it's like giving advice to somebody who's too heavy. You know the answer the doctor's going to say. He's going to say exercise and eat less. And you know what a doctor's going to say, given this easily transmitted respiratory virus. It's basically what we call the three Ds. Distance, you keep your distance from other people. Duration, you limit the time or duration you're in front of other people. And diversity, you lower the diversity or amount of people that you meet on any given day. These are the basic premises of social distancing. But of course, just like losing weight, it's hard to do this. And it's hard to do it for a long period of time. Human beings are social creatures. They like being out and about. And I fully understand what a total drag this is. But we're talking about a life or death situation. So that's where good public health communication and even encouragement, cheering on people who are doing this on a regular basis for being good citizens is critical. And that's why I spend a lot of my day doing precisely that. No, it's very hard. I understand that. It's hard economically. For some, it's really hard economically who have lost their jobs. It's hard socially. It's hard in terms of, say, people with elderly parents who are in assisted living, but they can't see them on a regular basis. I understand that. But look at what we're dealing with. And look at how bad the situation has got. America leads the world in COVID. That is not a good statistic you want to brag about.
One of the things you say in your New Yorker story is the challenge, therefore, isn't just flattening the curve, but keeping it flat, holding the line, taking a deep breath here, not for months, but for years.
Well, that may be because we're waiting. And this was always when we were planning these kinds of methods in the early 2000s, the aughties, we never really expected to have a viral threat last this long. In this case, we're waiting for science and medical practice to catch up. And that means developing a vaccine for an RNA virus that has never been developed or created before, having it jump through all the regulatory hoops of phase 1-3 trials, double-blinded trials of licensure and actual manufacture, and then getting into the arms of people, or perhaps a development of a drug or drugs that can treat people very effectively, as we can, say, with the HIV virus. But we're waiting for medicine and science to catch up. And I have, thousands of colleagues, scientists and doctors who are working feverishly, no pun intended, around the clock to do just that. But until we have an effective preventative or treatment, we're kind of stuck.
You tweeted something recently that ended with, "I fear that we are headed, given the way it's being handled, to the worst contagious crisis in human history." You still feel that way?
Yes, I do. And I am not an alarmist. I'm generally quite the opposite. I'm not an alarmist in my public writing. I might be in my personal life, but I'm not an alarmist publicly, and I don't say things like that without having good reason. And the way it's going, if it's not the worst, it'll certainly be in the top five. It's running very close to influenza of 1918 right now. It's still behind that. But if we don't get a handle on that, it could indeed match that. But it is, without doubt, one of the great, if not the greatest, contagious crises in human history. Of that, I have no doubt. And that's based on studying and reading about epidemics for many more years than I care to relate. So it's the scope of how many people are getting sick and dying. That makes it one of the worst in history.
And speaking of your personal life, you shared a personal situation in the New Yorker article about how COVID-19 impacted you. Can you share it with us here on 89.1 WEMU?
Well, sure. You know, it's funny. I shared that at the very end of the New Yorker piece at my editor's urging, and it's amazing how many letters I got. My mother, who was 83 years old, and she suffered from a terrible neurodegenerative illness called supranuclear palsy, and it's kind of a combination of Alzheimer's, Lou Gehrig's, and Parkinson's all rolled into one. And it was a really tough last few years for her. And she contracted the virus, started with symptoms in the morning, was gone by the night. So we could see how quickly this attacks and ravages and kills. And so it was in late February. And I know this is an odd thing to say, but I'm grateful that she's not suffering. But I'm also grateful that we could actually have a funeral back then. This was before the social distancing measures were put into effect. So at least she had a proper funeral, and her family could mourn her the way we chose to.
Well, our condolences to you, and thanks for sharing that with us here. Dr. Howard
Thank
Markell
you.
From the University of Michigan, thanks for sharing all of your insight, knowledge, and wisdom with us on 89.1 WEMU.
Well, my mother always listened to me on the radio. She would have enjoyed being mentioned. So, thank you.